Part 3. 17. Maracy had read a lot about life in the roughs in her youth and knew what to expect of a stagecoach trip. Boredom, dust, and discomfort. It was wonderful. She had to forcibly keep herself from hanging out the window, as Wayne occasionally did, watching the scenery pass. They weren't in the roughs, but this was close enough. The smell of the horses, the bumps in the road, the rickety creak of the wood and the springs. She had seen and done some remarkable things during her time with Waxillium, but this really felt as if she were living in an adventure. Waxillium reclined across from her, feet up on the seat next to her, a wide-brimmed hat over his eyes, face bristly from a day without shaving. He'd removed his boots, which sat on the floor beside his shotgun. It seemed surreal to remember she'd even considered a relationship with him, now that so long had passed with them working together. No, she was not interested, no longer. But she did admire the perfect image of him there, the gun, the boots, and the hat. Of course, that image was distorted by the sight of Steris curled up on the seat beside him, snoring softly with her head on his shoulder. In what kind of bizarre world did Maracy's punctilious half-sister end up on the adventure? Steris belonged in a sitting room with a cup of tea and a dry book about horticulture, not riding cross-country in a stagecoach toward a potential army of allomancers. Yet here she was, snuggled up against Dawnshot himself. Maracy shook her head. She wasn't envious of Steris, which was, frankly, remarkable, considering their upbringings. It was very hard to hate Steris. You could be bored by her, confused by her, or frustrated with her, but hate her? Impossible. Maracy got out her notebook to continue her report to Vendel and Constable General Reddy, which she hoped to be able to send before reaching Dulsing. Waxillium shifted, then tipped his hat back, eyeing her. "You should get some sleep."
"I'll rest when we stop."
"Stop?" Maracy hesitated. They'd been going for half a day already, avoiding the main roads to evade potential pursuers from New Saren. They'd crossed several fields and spent a full hour rattling along a stone ridge to bypass some farms below in a way that left little sign of their passage. Their path lay almost directly northeast of New Saren, skirting the mountains to their right, staying to the foothills, which meant some ups and downs. But this was still good farmland. All of the basin was, even here at the edges, where things were drier than in the center.
"I thought that after stopping last night," Maracy said. "Dear, you mean to go straight there?"
"Straight is an odd term," Waxillium said, "considering how much Milan has us weaving to avoid getting caught, but yes, shouldn't be more than another 4 hours or so." A train could have had them there in a fraction of that time, delivered in comfort. Maybe the outer cities did have reason to gripe about the way things were set up.
"Waxillium,"
Maracy said as he shifted again.
"Do you think they're real? The bands of mourning?"
He tipped back his hat all the way. "Did I ever tell you why I went to the roughs?"
"As a youth," Maracy said. "It was because you hated the politics, the expectations. Polite society that was anything but polite."
"That's why I left Ellendale," Waxillium said. "But why the roughs? I could have gone to one of the outer cities, could have found a plantation somewhere to read books and live a quiet life."
"Well,"
Maracy frowned,
"I guess I thought you always wanted to be a lawman."
Waxillium smiled. "I wish I'd spotted it that easily. Should have. I spent my childhood tattling on other children for every little thing they did."
"Then what?"
He settled back, closing his eyes. "I was chasing a legend, Maracy. Tales of the survivor's gold. Riches to be had. Stories to be made."
"You?"
Maracy started.
"You were a gentleman adventurer?"
Waxillium winced visibly at the term. "You make me sound like that fool in the broadsheets. I tell you, Maracy, those first months were hard. Every other town was full of the unemployed from the mines shutting down,
and I couldn't enter a saloon without finding some fool babyface like myself up from the basin with a head full of glory and treasure.
So you started hunting bounties, she said. You told me this part. Something about boots.
Eventually, yes, Waxillium said, smiling. Struggled for a long time up there before turning to bounties. At first, though, I had my eyes full of riches and gold. Took time to shake that out of me, but even then, becoming a lawman was about the cash. Started hunting men for money. And, well, there'd always been this streak in me that didn't like seeing people get pushed around. Ended up in Wuthering. Just another forgotten, dried-out city in the roughs with nobody to care about it. It was 6 years before someone gave me credentials and made it official.
The stagecoach cabin swayed on its straps. Up above, Marisi could hear Wayne and Milan chatting, so long as they weren't making out again while trying to drive.
When Vendel told us about this, I didn't want the bands to be real, Waxillium said, looking out the window. I hated the thought of some foolish dream pulling me away again, after I'd finally found stability in Ellendale. I didn't want that lure of excitement, a reminder of a world I'd come to love out there in the dust.
So you think they are real?
Here's the thing, he said, leaning forward, causing Steris to shift in her sleep. My uncle hasn't had time to breed his allomancers, as I suspect he's been doing. The plans he and the set have concocted, they're long-term investments. But he promised something to Kelesina, and he really sounded like he thinks he can deliver. You have the device?
Marisi pulled the small metal cube from her purse. Waxillium fished in his pocket and brought out his coin, the one some beggar had apparently given him. He held up the two next to each other, sunlight through the window gleaming off the cube and highlighting the otherworldly symbols on its sides.
Something strange is going on, Marisi, Waxillium said. Something important enough to draw my uncle's attention. I don't have the answers. I need to find them.
She found herself smiling at the intensity in his eyes. It's not the treasure hunter that made you decide to go to Dulsing. It's the detective. He smiled.
You were listening to what Milan said to me last night?
Marisi nodded.
You were supposed to be asleep, Waxillium said.
He flipped the coin, caught it, tossed the cube back to her.
Going to Aradel would have been the mature, prudent move, but I have to find the answers. And who knows? Maybe the bands are real. If so, then getting them away from Suit is at least as important as informing the governor of what happened in New Saren.
You think your uncle is trying to make allomancers with technology rather than by birth?
A frightening power in the hands of a man like my uncle, Waxillium said, leaning back into his seat. Get some sleep. We're probably going to infiltrate this building project in Dulsing during the night.
He settled with his hat over his eyes again. Marisi felt she should do as he said, and so tried to doze off. Unfortunately, there were too many thoughts in her head for sleep. After some time, she gave up and returned to her letter. In it, she explained what they'd done and discovered. She'd needed to send this soon. Perhaps she could find a telegraph station when they changed horses and send the letter in time for it to make a difference. Once done with the letter, she moved to her notes about the missing Chondra spike. Kelesina, acting on behalf of the Set, had tried to kill Relur and had assumed success. When Suit had demanded proof, she'd ordered the spike dug up and sent to him in Dulsing. But where would it be kept there? Someplace secure, presumably. How in the world was she going to find it?
She held up the little cube. Suit had asked after this. Could she use that somehow?
Marisi frowned, turning the cube. The sides had little grooves between them. She looked closer and in the sunlight spotted something she hadn't seen before. A tiny little knob hidden in one groove. It looked like, well, a switch. Nestled in, where it couldn't be flipped accidentally. She used a hairpin to reach in and flip the switch. It moved just as she'd expected it to. A switch.
It seemed so mundane. This was either a mystical relic or some kind of secret technology. You didn't use a switch on things like that. You held them up to starlight or spoke the special command phrases or did a dance on the last day of the month while eating a kumquat. The switch didn't seem to have done anything, so Maracy swallowed and burned a pinch of cadmium. The cube began to vibrate in her fingers. The entire coach lurched, rocking as if it had been struck by something very hard. Maracy hit her head on the roof, then was slammed back down onto her seat. The horses screamed, but Milan somehow kept them under control. Within moments, the coach had pulled to a stop.
"What the hell was that?"
Waxillium said, hauling himself up off the floor where he had ended up in a jumble with Steris. Maracy groaned, sitting up and holding her head.
"I did something stupid."
"How stupid?" Waxillium asked.
"I was testing the device," Maracy said, "and used allomancy."
Wayne's head appeared at the door a moment later, hanging down from above.
"Was that a speed bubble?"
"Yes," Maracy said.
"That jolt damn near killed the horses," Wayne said.
"I'm sorry, I'm sorry."
Waxillium helped Steris sit up.
"What? What went wrong?" she asked, befuddled.
"Maracy used a speed bubble while we were moving," Waxillium said. "We hit the threshold and towed her out of it, popping the thing and lurching us from one time frame to the next."
"But she used it on the train," Steris said.
"Speed bubbles move with you if you're on something massive enough," Waxillium said. "Otherwise, the spinning of the planet would pop you out of everyone you made. The train was heavy and fast. The stagecoach is small and just slow enough, so..."
"So I should have known better," Maracy said, blushing. "I haven't done that since I was a kid. But Waxillium, it buzzed."
"What?"
"The cube, it..."
Maracy started, realizing she'd dropped the cube in the confusion. She searched around frantically before finally locating it near his foot. She held it up triumphantly.
"It had a switch."
"A switch?" She turned it to the side, showing them the little switch.
"You have to slip something small in to move it," she said. "But it works now."
He looked at it, baffled, then showed it to Steris, who squinted.
"What kind of eldritch device," Steris said, "has an on switch?"
"Makes sense, I guess," Waxillium said. "You don't want your eldritch devices turning on accidentally."
"Might end up almost killing your stagecoach drivers," Wayne grumbled.
"It didn't stop your allomancy?" Waxillium asked Maracy, rubbing his chin. She shook her head. She could still sense her metal reserves.
"It didn't seem to do anything."
"Huh," Waxillium held it up. "Could be dangerous."
"So we're testing it then?"
Wayne asked, hanging into the window.
"Of course we are," Waxillium said. "But away from the coach."
Wax held the vibrating cube in his hand. It did respond to his metal burning, but didn't seem to do anything else. They'd stopped near a stand of towering walnut trees, and Wayne was filling his pockets while Maracy watched Wax experiment from a safe distance. Milan watered the horses at a stream down the way. Nearby, a field of carrots grew with green sprouts, completely uncultivated. The air smelled fresh, of life untouched. He held up the buzzing cube and let his metals die off. The cube stopped vibrating. He burned them again, and it responded, starting slowly but picking up after about a second or two. But what did it do? Why didn't it blank his allomancy as it had on the train?
Maybe it doesn't work on the person activating it, he thought.
That would make some kind of sense, though he couldn't fathom how it could tell.
"Hey, Wayne," he said.
"Yeah, mate?"
"Catch."
Wax tossed the cube to him. Wayne caught it, then jumped as his belt, which held his metal vials and any coins on his person, ripped free from its breakaway straps and sprang away from him. He turned, watching it flop to the ground a good 20 feet down the hill, and when he approached it, it scooted away. Wax ran toward him, and as he did, the shotgun in his leg holster pressed backward as if being pushed. The effect wore off a few seconds later, and by the time he reached Wayne, the cube had stopped buzzing. Wayne held it up.
"What was that?"
Wax plucked the device from his fingers as Marcy rushed over to join them.
It doesn't steal Allomancy, Wayne. It never did.
But
it takes the metal one is burning, Wax said, and somehow extends it. You saw. It pushed your metal away as if a coin shot were there near you. The cube used Allomancy.
The three of them stood, stunned, looking at the little device.
We need to try it again, Wax said. Wayne, hold this and burn your bend alloy. Marcy, go stand over there. Wayne, once you're ready, throw the cube to her.
They did as directed. Wax stood back. When Wayne ignited his metals, he suddenly became a blur inside his speed bubble. The cube zipped out an eye blink later and soared through the air toward Marcy, deflected somewhat but still moving in the right direction. It engaged just before reaching her, and she became a blur, zipping over to pick up the cube, then zipping back. It took a count of 10 before the cube stopped working, dropping her into ordinary time.
"Did you see that?" Marcy said, awed, holding the cube. "It created a speed bubble for me. It fed off Wayne's Allomancy and replicated it."
"It's what we've been looking for, then?"
Wayne asked, joining them, having dropped his own bubble.
"Not quite," Wax replied, taking the cube and holding it up. "But it's certainly encouraging. It looks like you have to be an Allomancer to use this. It doesn't grant new powers, but it does extend the ones you have. It's like an Allomantic grenade."
Marcy nodded eagerly.
"Which means that the man on the train, the one who used this on us, is a leecher. He can remove Allomancy in others, and he gave that power to the cube which he threw at you."
"It engages a second or so after you throw it," Wax said with a nod. "Useful."
"And it's proof that Suit has technology he's been hiding," Marcy said.
"We knew that from the communication device," Wax said. "But yes, this is even more curious. I'm half tempted to think all this talk of the Bands of Mourning came from rumors of this technology the set has been developing."
"And the symbols?"
"No idea," Wax said. "Some kind of cipher they developed?"
He tapped the cube, then handed the thing to Marcy.
"Why me?"
she asked.
"It's yours. You found it. You figured out how to turn it on. Besides, I have a feeling it's going to be the most effective in your hands."
She held it a moment, then her eyes widened. Being a pulser wasn't very useful when you were catching yourself in a bubble where you moved slowly compared to everyone else. However, if you could trap someone else in that bubble... Wayne whistled softly.
"I'll try not to lose it," Marcy said, tucking the device away. "We'll need to study it later. Find out how it works."
"I wonder," Wax thought, remembering something else.
He played his hunch, reaching into his pocket and fishing out the golden bracelet that Kalasina had been wearing. He tossed it to Wayne.
"What's this?"
Wayne asked, holding it up toward the sky.
"Pretty hoop of gold, that is. Who'd you trade this off of? I could use this, mate. It would make a nice metal mine."
"I think it's already one," Wax said, deflating. It had been a silly idea in the first place.
Wayne gasped.
"What?"
Marcy said.
"It's a metal mind," Wayne said. "Damn me, but it is. And I can sense it. Wax, you got your knife?"
Wax nodded, yanking his knife from his gun belt, and when Wayne proffered his hand, he sliced a small cut along the back. It resealed immediately.
"Mate," Wayne whispered. "It's someone else's metal mind, but I can use it."
"Like Vandel said," Wax said, taking the bracelet from Wayne's fingers. "A metal mind with no identity. Rusts. I have to flare my metal to even get the faintest line pointing to it. This thing must be stuffed full of power."
More than any metal mind he'd ever sensed, in fact. He could usually push on those without too much trouble. He'd barely been able to shift this one.
"Why didn't I notice what it was immediately?" Wayne said. "I had to be told. And, oh, rosts! This is proof of the Bands of Mourning, ain't it?"
"No," Wax said. "I can't sense a reserve in the bracelet. I can't use it, as I'm not a blood maker. It's not a metal mind anybody can use, just one that anyone with the right powers already can use."
"That's still remarkable," Marcy said.
"And disturbing," Wax said,
staring at that innocent-looking loop. The only way to have created this would involve using a ferrochemist with two powers, so either the Set had access to full-blooded ferrochemists, or his fears were coming true. They'd figured out how to use hemallergy.
Or it's a relic, he thought. There's that possibility. Perhaps this and the box were artifacts of another time.
He tossed the bracelet back to Wayne. How much is in it?
A heap, Wayne said. But it's not endless. The reservoir got smaller when I healed that cut.
Hang on to it, then, Wax said, turning as he heard his name. Milan was at the edge of the glade, waving. Wax left Wayne and Marcy, striding over to the tall, slender Condor woman, still worried about what these discoveries meant. What did the bracelet indicate? Was there more to be discovered? Metal mines that granted anyone who touched them incredible powers? For the first time, he really started to wonder. What if the bands were real? What would happen to society if metal-born powers were simply something you could purchase? He trudged up to Milan.
I think you'll want to see this, she said, waving for him to follow her up the side of a steep hill covered in foliage.
At the top, they had a view of the land to the northeast. Some was cultivated in rows and rings, but much was like what they'd just left, wilderness blooming with random patches of fruits or vegetables. A cool breeze blew across him, barely enough to temper the heat of the sunlight above. Seeing it all, feeling that perfect breeze, made Wax realize what annoyed him so much about the problems between Ellendale and the outer cities. Did these people comprehend what life was like out in the roughs, where planting was fraught with uncertainty and the danger of starvation was real?
They think people are foolish for living in the roughs, Wax thought, taking the old-fashioned spyglass that Milan handed him. They don't understand what it's like to get trapped out there for generations, too poor or too stubborn to return to the basin.
Freedom in the roughs came at a cost. Either way, the basin was literally paradise, crafted for men by a god who wanted to compensate the world for a millennium of ashes and ruin. It seemed that even in paradise, men would find reasons to squabble and fight. Wax raised the spyglass.
What am I looking for? Check the road about a mile up, Milan said. By that creek with the bridge over it.
He spotted a couple of men lounging in a field with axes. From the looks of it, they'd been cutting at the trunk of a dead tree. Another fallen tree crossed the roadway.
What do you see?
Milan asked.
A roadblock that doesn't want to look like one, Wax said. That tree across the road is arranged to seem as if it just fell there, but the furrows on the ground indicate it was dragged there intentionally and has been moved a time or two since being placed.
Good eye,
Milan said.
You can't have it, he said, turning the spyglass and looking toward the farmsteads in the area. Soldiers stationed in that farmhouse over there, I'd guess, and none of the other homes have smoke rising from them. Probably abandoned. You're unlikely to find a farmstead this time of day without dinner in the oven.
They're waiting for us?
No, this is too extensive for that, Wax said. This is a perimeter. They're trying not to have it look like one to prevent word from spreading. But they've cordoned off this entire area. What the hell is happening in there?
Milan shook her head, looking baffled.
Well, we can't take the coach any farther, Wax said, handing back the spyglass. How are you at bareback?
Well, I haven't thrown any riders off recently, but I don't get occasion to be a horse very often, so I can't say how I'll feel today.
Wax blinked.
Oh, you meant riding, Milan said. Yeah, I'm fine. I doubt I'm the one you'll have to worry about.
She nodded back toward Steris, walking into the grove, trailed by Wayne, who had filled his hat with walnuts.
Right, Wax said. Hopefully, some of their horses would prove docile.
Twilight settled upon the land fitfully, like a tired eye struggling to stay open. It was the variety of the land down here in the south, Wax figured. One moment you could be riding through a wooded hollow, all in shadow, and the next you'd crest a hill into an open field and find that the sun hadn't quite dropped below the horizon yet. Still, darkness did eventually arrive, but with it came no mists. Wax realized he'd been longing to feel them envelop him again. Milan led the sortie, keeping to forested areas when possible. She or Wayne would scout ahead, listening for patrols, but the set was attempting to hold such a large area that they obviously couldn't watch the whole wilderness. Maracy, of course, was an accomplished rider, and seemed pleased to have a reason to change into her new constable's trousers and jacket. Steris surprised him. She did just fine, even riding in a skirt. She'd packed one full enough that she could tuck it beneath her and ride bareback without exposing too much. She took to it without complaint, as she'd done with practically everything else on this trip. The few farmsteads or hunters' camps they passed on their ride were empty. Wax felt a mounting disquiet. Yes, this was a small, largely unpopulated region in the basin's backwaters, but it was still profoundly disturbing that the set could dominate it so fully. Once they reached the final patch of trees near the village, Milan scouted ahead, then came back and waved for him to follow. He crawled up with her to peer at the village from the tree line. Bright, electric floodlights lit the perimeter around an enormous structure in what obviously had once been the center of the village of Dalsing. Wooden, windowless, huge, it was still under construction, judging by the scaffolding at the sides and the unfinished roof at the top. The town's buildings had mostly been torn down, leaving only a few at the perimeter untouched. The roofless top of the building glowed with a warm light. Where were they getting so much electricity? Milan handed him the spyglass, and he raised it, inspecting the perimeter. Those were definitely soldiers wearing red uniforms with some mark on the breast that wasn't distinguishable at this distance. They carried rifles at their shoulders, and the floodlights created a bright ring around the place. Focused outward, not toward the building, which left plenty of shadowed areas inside that ring. So they'd have cover once they got past the perimeter.
"What do you think?" he asked. "Is that some kind of bunker?"
"Doesn't look like any fort I've seen," Milan whispered. "With those flimsy walls, looks more like a big warehouse."
"A warehouse as large as a small town." Wax shook his head in bafflement, then spotted something near the far side of the village. A waterfall? It was outside the lights, but he thought he could see mist rising from where it plunged down, and a small stream did run through the village.
"High ground that direction," he said.
"Yeah," she said. "The maps mention the waterfall over there. Small but pretty, supposedly."
"Must have hooked up a turbine to it," he said. "That's where the power is coming from. Let's get back to the others."
They crawled through the underbrush again to where Wayne, Maracy, and Steris waited in the dim woods.
"They're here all right," Wax whispered. "We have to find a way to get in. Tons of soldiers. Well-guarded perimeter."
"Fly in,"
Steris suggested.
"Not going to work," Wayne said. "They had a seeker back at the party. You think they won't have one here? The moment one of us burns a medal, we'll draw 100 of Suit's goons to welcome us with a handshake and a friendly bit of murdering."
"What then?"
Maracy asked.
"I need to see," Wayne said.
"There's a better vantage point on the other side, we think," Wax said.
He pointed, and Milan led the way in the darkness, walking her horse between the towering hardwoods. Wax fell in with Steris at the tail of the group and lagged a little to be able to speak with her privately.
"Steris," he whispered, "I've been considering how to proceed once we decide how to infiltrate. I've thought about bringing you in with us, and I just don't see that it's feasible. I think it would be best if you stayed and watched the horses."
"Very well."
"No, really. Those are armed soldiers. I can't even fathom how I'd feel if I brought you in there and something happened. You need to stay out here."
"Very well."
"It isn't subject to..." Wax hesitated. "Wait. You're all right with this?"
"Why wouldn't I be?" she asked. "I barely have any sense of where to point a gun, and have hardly any capacity for sneaking. That's really quite a scandalous talent, if you think about it, Lord Waxillium. While I do believe that people tend to be safest when near you, riding into an enemy compound is stretching the issue. I'll stay here."
Wax grinned in the darkness.
"Steris, you're a gem."
"What? Because I have a moderately healthy sense of self-preservation?"
"Let's just say that out in the roughs,
I was accustomed to people always wanting to try things beyond their capacity, and they always seemed determined to do it right when it was the most dangerous.
Well, I shall endeavor to stay out of sight, Steris said, and not get captured.
I doubt you need to worry about that all the way out here.
Oh, I agree, she said. But that is the sort of statistical anomaly that plagues my life, so I'll plan for it nonetheless.
With some difficulty, they navigated to the eastern edge of the town, where they left Steris and the horses. Wax dug some supplies off the pack animal. Metal vials, extra bullets, plenty of guns, including the aluminum one he'd stolen back at Kelesina's place. And the last of Renette's ball-and-string devices, which he tucked into the pouch on his gun belt. After climbing up some switchbacks, they were able to settle onto a darkened ridge above the falls, which were nowhere near as impressive as he'd imagined, and study the town. Well, the remnants of it.
I wish we could see into that building,
Marcy said, handing back the spyglass. Wax grunted in agreement. They were almost high enough to see what was going on inside. Certainly, those flickering lights bespoke considerable activity. People moving down below, passing before the lights in the large chamber. But what were they doing? And why were they still at it well into the night?
Gonna be hard to sneak in there, Wayne said.
You could kill one of the guards for me,
Milan said, settling onto a rock.
I'd eat him, take his shape, and slip us in that way.
Wax blinked, then glanced at Marcy, who seemed sick.
Really?
Milan said.
You all need to stop staring at me like that when I offer pragmatic suggestions.
It's not pragmatic, Marcy said. It's cannibalism.
Technically, it's not, as we're different species. Honestly, if you look at our physiology, I share less in common with humans than you do with a cow. And nobody gasps when you eat one of those. You didn't have trouble with it back in the mansion with Innate's bodyguard.
She was already dead, Wax said. Thank you for the suggestion, Milan, but getting you a guard's body is out of the question.
We don't like killing folks, Wayne said. At least, unless they start shooting at us. They're just chaps what are doing their job.
He looked to Marcy as if for support.
Don't look at me, Marcy said. I'm reeling from watching you trying to take the moral high ground.
Focus, Wayne, Wax said. How are we going to get in? Shall we try a fat belt?
Nah, Wayne said. Too loud. I think we should do spoiled tomato.
Dangerous, Wax said, shaking his head. I'd have to do the placement just right, between the perimeter and the shadowed part near the walls.
You can do it. You make shots like that all the time. Plus we got this shiny new metal mind full of health waiting to be slurped up.
A mistake could ruin the whole infiltration, healing power or no, Wax said. I think we should do duck under clouds instead.
You kidding? Wayne said. Didn't you get shot last time we tried that?
Kinda, Wax admitted. Milan stared at them, baffled.
Duck under clouds.
They get like this, Marcy said, patting her on the shoulder. Best not to listen too closely.
Tube run, Wayne said.
No glue.
Banefielder?
Too dark.
Blackwatch double stomp.
Wax hesitated.
The hell is that?
Just made it up, Wayne said, grinning. It's a nifty code name, though, eh?
Not bad, Wax admitted. And what type of plan is it?
Same as spoiled tomato, Wayne said.
I said that was too dangerous.
Nothing else will work, Wayne said, standing. Look, are we going to sit here arguing, or are we going to do this?
Wax debated for a moment, eyeing the grounds, thinking. Could he get the placement right? But then, did he have a better plan? That perimeter was very well guarded, but it was a dark night. If his life in the roughs had taught him one thing, it was to trust his instincts. Unfortunately, at that moment, they agreed with Wayne. So, before he could talk himself out of it, he pulled his shotgun from its holster and tossed it to Wayne. The shorter man caught it with distaste. Guns and Wayne didn't agree. His arms immediately started shaking. Try to hold on tight, Wax said. Make an opening on the north side if you can. He increased his weight, flared his metal, and pushed on the gun, using it as an anchor to hurl Wayne out off the rocky outcropping and over the camp. The man soared from the push before dropping through the darkness some 50 feet toward the ground below. Marcy gasped.
"Spoiled tomato?" she asked.
"Yeah," Wax said. "Apparently it makes a mess sometimes when he lands."
"To rust with that wax," Wayne thought as he plummeted toward the ground, his hat blowing off. "Tossing a gun to a fellow without even warning him? Why, that's just..."
He hit. Now, there was a trick to falling to your death. Bodies hitting the ground were loud, louder than anyone ever expected. He mitigated this by hitting feet first. His legs both snapped immediately, then twisted onto his side, breaking his shoulder, but dampening some of the sound by rolling with the impact. He tapped his fancy new metal mind right before his head smacked the ground, dazing him. He ended up in a crumpled, broken heap beside a pile of rocks. Of course Wax would have sent him into a pile of rocks. As his vision cleared, he tried to glance at his legs, but he couldn't move. Couldn't feel anything, actually, which was quite pleasant. It was always nice when you snapped the spine. Helped with the pain. Not that pain went completely away, mind you, but he and Payne were old friends, what shared a handshake and a beer now and then. Didn't much like one another, but they had a working relationship. Sensation and agony flooded back into him as his metal mind healed his spine, focusing on the worst wounds first. He drew in a deep breath. A snapped spine could suffocate a man. People didn't know that. Or, well, the ones who did know had suffocated already. As soon as he could move, even while his legs were healing, he twisted and used his good arm to position one of the large rocks in the pile. Looked like these stones were here intended for shoring up the sides of the stream, perhaps to make a pathway across. Wayne put them to good use, reaching up with his other hand as his shoulder healed. Wax had placed him well, right in the dark area between the perimeter watch posts and the building. But that didn't mean he was safe. Wayne stumbled to his feet, dragging Wax's gun, his leg twisting about and bones re-knitting. Damn fine metal mind that gold bracelet was. An extensive healing like this would have cost him months of saving up, but this metal mind was still mostly full. He stumbled away as quietly as he could, leaving a large rock balanced on the others as he sought a place deeper in the shadows, then hid the gun near the building so his damn hand would stop shaking. He got away none too soon. A pair of soldiers were approaching from the perimeter.
"It was over here," one said to the other.
As they drew closer, one of the spotlights turned around and shone on the area, giving them light and quite nearly exposing Wayne. He froze in the shadows near a pile of work equipment, sweating as his toes popped softly, the bones grinding against one another as they knit back into their proper places. The guards didn't hear. They stepped up to where he'd fallen, no tomato splat of blood this time, fortunately, and looked around. One nudged the stone accidentally, and it fell off the peak where Wayne had placed it, rolling down the side of the small pile and clattering against the other rocks. The men looked at it, then nodded, doing a quick sweep before heading back to their post and returning the light to its scan of the nearby area. The noise they'd heard had merely been some rocks shifting. Nothing significant. Wayne stood up straight in the darkness and stopped tapping the bracelet metal mind. He felt good, renewed, like he always did after a big healing. Felt like he could do something impossible, run up a mountain, or eat the entire boar and chips plate at Findlay's all on his own. He crept off through the shadows about important business. Fortunately, he found his hat almost immediately, near another rock pile. That done, he moved on to less important matters, like making an opportunity to help the others sneak in. Wax had said north side. Let's see. He kept close to the building, and even resisted the urge to go sneaking in on his own to find out what in ruin's name was in there. Time to think like a guard. It was hard, as he didn't have a guard's hat. He settled into the shadows and listened as a pair of them passed on patrol, digesting their accents, like a nice snack of pretzel sticks with mustard. After about 15 minutes of watching, he picked out a likely candidate and kept pace as the man did his rounds, though Wayne stayed in the shadow. The lanky fellow had a face like a rabbit, but was tall enough he could probably have picked all the walnuts he wanted without needing a stepladder.
Here I am, Wayne thought, in the middle of nowhere, guarding a big old barn. This isn't what I signed up for. I haven't seen my daughter in 8 months. 8 months! She's probably talking by now. Rusts. This life.
The man turned to go back the other way on his rounds, and someone barked out at him from one of the stations with the floodlights, saying something. Wayne couldn't hear. The tone was unmistakable.
And my superiors, Wayne thought, turning and slinking along in the shadows, still keeping pace with the man. Oh, how they lean on me. Every little thing gets me a-talking to. Shouting. That's all this life is. Being yelled at day in and day out.
Wayne smiled, then scuttled ahead of the man, looking for something he'd stepped over earlier. A set of black cords, each as thick as his finger, plugged into a big cigar box near the building. As the guard came strolling past, not paying attention, Wayne carefully lifted the cords. The guard's foot caught on them. In that moment, Wayne yanked them from the hub. The floodlights nearest to him went out. Men immediately started shouting. The guard panicked in the darkness.
"I'm sorry," he shouted. "I didn't mean to. I wasn't washing my feet."
Wayne slipped away and found a nice quiet nook between two stacks of sandbags as the guards shouted and argued, and the poor man was chewed out. Some people came in to fix the cords, though Wayne had tossed them to the side, so it took some time searching in the dark to find the ends and get them connected. The lights came back on. Wayne was taking a long swig from his leather canteen as Wax, Marcy, and Milan joined him in the shadows.
"Nice," Wax whispered. "It wasn't, actually," Wayne whispered. "It was pretty mean. That poor guard ain't done nothing wrong, and everybody keeps yelling at him."
Wax took the lead at that point, prowling along the side of the big barn-like building. The roof wasn't the only thing still unfinished. The entrances were open, not fitted with proper doors. They stopped beside one, and Wayne pointed, whispering to Wax where his shotgun was. Wax fetched it, then snuck through the doorway. They followed. Wayne last of all. The cavernous interior was lit by a few electric lanterns here and there, and they passed a long light lattice that was obviously going to be installed in the ceiling once the roof was done. It was brighter than outside in here, but not by much, and there were stacks of boxes and supplies arranged in rows which let them sneak through and stay hidden. Once they got to the front of the rows of boxes, Wax hesitated, and the two women peered around him. Nobody gave Wayne a good view, which was how it always went. First he got yelled at on the job, then this. He wiggled between them, getting a good elbow into Marcy's midriff, which earned him a glare, as if she didn't know that proper crowd-wiggling protocol involved getting friendly with one another's extremities. He managed to peek between Wax and Milan, finally getting a glimpse at what had stopped them. It was a boat. Of course, the common word, boat, didn't do the thing justice. Wayne stared at the massive construction, searching for a better description. One that would capture the majesty, the incredible scale of the thing he was seeing.
"That's a damn big boat," he finally whispered.
"Much better." Why would they be building a ship here, miles and miles from the ocean? The thing couldn't be easy to move. It filled almost the entire building, with a curved bottom and a prow. Unfinished on one side, that was easily 3 stories high. The thing had 2 long, arm-like extensions at the sides. Pontoons? They were big, and one wasn't finished yet, ending in a jagged line of construction.
Jagged?
Wayne frowned. That didn't look like the way you built something. In fact, now that he studied it, that prow looked more crumpled than unfinished.
"Someone broke it," Wayne said, pointing. "They were trying to move it and cracked off one pontoon."
"It has to be a warship," Marcy said. "They are preparing for a war."
"I think Wayne is right," Wax said. "Look at the gouges in the dirt, the damage to the hull. They were transporting this thing through here, and it rolled free and cracked, so the set constructed this building to cut it off from view of anyone outside while they repair it."
"Engineers," Wayne said,
pointing at some people who were obviously smart types, walking along the outside of the ship and pointing, carrying clipboards and wearing dark brown suits and skirts, the type teachers at schools would wear, thinking they were the height of fashion.
"It's not like any ship I've seen," Marcy said,
shouldering her purse and clutching her rifle.
"You brought your purse," Wayne said, "on a Darren infiltration?"
"Why not?" she said. "Purses are handy. Anyway, if the set has technology like that speaking telegraph, what will they put on a ship like this? And why did they build it away from the sea in the first place?"
"Suit will have answers," Wax said, eyes narrowing. "Marcy, I assume you're still after the spike?"
"Yes," she said, determined.
"I'm going to find my uncle. Who do you want, Wayne or Milan?"
"Milan, this time," Marcy said.
Wax nodded.
"Stay hidden. But if Wayne and I get spotted, try to help. We'll do the same for you. If you find that spike, return to this point and lie low. If all goes well, we'll slip back out together."
"And if all doesn't go well?"
"Which it won't," Wayne added.
"Meet back where we left Steris and the horses," Wax said, sliding a gun from the holster at his side.
Milan did the same, only her holster was her leg. Like, the skin split, and she reached in through a slit in her trousers and slipped the gun out. A sleek, long-barreled thing. Wayne whistled softly. She grinned, then gave him a kiss.
"Try not to get shot too many times."
"You neither," he said.
They split up. 18. Marcy snuck through the warehouse, her rifle's strap an uncomfortable weight on her shoulder. She was glad for the trousers, they were quieter than rustling skirts, but she kept worrying that the scientists and workers in the room would notice the sound of her boots on the packed earth. Probably not. The warehouse was hardly silent. Though it was night and activity was muted, some people were still working. Along one side of the room, a few carpenters sawed lengths of wood, each stroke echoing back from the walls. The group of engineers made exclamations as they discussed aspects of the large vessel.
"They seem surprised by it," Marcy thought, "as if they're not the ones who built it in the first place."
Were they new to the project, then? Guards dotted the warehouse, but there weren't nearly as many as outside. She and Milan kept to the shadowed edge of the chamber, near the piles of boxes and supplies, but still had to pass uncomfortably close to a group of soldiers sitting at a small table playing cards. The soldiers didn't notice them. Eventually, Milan and Marcy managed to reach the south wall, which was one of the long sides of the rectangular building. Here, rooms had been built into the structure, and they were more furnished than the rest, complete with doors and the occasional window.
"Living quarters?" Marcy whispered, pointing.
"Maybe,"
Milan replied, crouching beside her.
"So how are we going to find the spike?"
"I'd assume it's inside a safe of some sort."
"Maybe,"
Milan said.
"Or it could be in a desk drawer in one of those rooms, or packed away in a box. Or hell, they may have just thrown it away. Suit only seemed to want it because he required proof that poor Relure had been dealt with."
Marcy took a deep breath.
"If that's the case, we'll have to interrogate Suit once Waxillium finds him. But I don't think they threw it away. We know the set is researching ways to make allomancers, and we know they're interested in hemallergy. They'd study the spike instead of tossing it."
Milan nodded thoughtfully.
"But it could still be practically anywhere."
Not far away, the scientists, led by a man with a limp, walked up a plank ramp, peering into the open side of the boat.
"It's him," Marcy thought.
"The same one from the train robbery." He was showing the newcomers around the project. They stepped inside.
"I've got an idea," Marcy said.
"How crazy is it?"
"Less crazy than tossing Wayne off a cliff."
"Not a high bar, but all right. How do we start?"
Marcy pointed at the hole in the hull that the scientists had entered through.
"We get in there."
Wax moved along behind the supply pallets in the direction opposite Marcy's, feeling as if he were stepping through the shadow of progress. He'd pondered the transformations that Ellendale had undergone during his absence. Motor cars and electric lights, skyscrapers and concrete roads. It was like he'd left one world and come back to another. That seemed only the beginning. Enormous warships, technology that enhanced allomancy, bracers that one ferrochemist could fill and another could use. He couldn't help but feel intimidated, as if this behemoth ship were a soldier from another time come to stamp out all the dusty old relics like wax. He pulled up beside the last stack of planks in the line, Wayne joining him. The man yanked out his canteen, which was of sturdy, stiff leather, worked to the shape of a small bottle. He took a swig and offered it to Wax, who accepted it and downed a drink. He coughed softly.
Apple juice?
Good for the body, Wayne said, tucking the canteen away.
I was not expecting that.
Gotta keep the stomach guessing, mate, Wayne said, or it'll grow complacent and all. How are we gonna find your uncle?
Perspective, Wax asked, nodding toward the middle reaches of the warehouse, where a complex network of temporary construction catwalks ringed the inside of the building. They were unpopulated in the night. We'd have a view of the entire area, but wouldn't be too noticeable from below.
Sounds good, Wayne said. You up for it, though? You're gonna have to climb up there like a regular person. No steel pushes.
He didn't have any metal inside of him. Too easy to use reflexively. His vials sat unused on his belt.
I'll be fine, Wax said dryly.
He waited until nearby guards and workers had passed, then led the way in a low run along the shadows of the building. The lights were aimed on the ship, away from the walls. He had to hope that the few workers walking about weren't focused on the dark reaches of the large chamber. Two full-sized catwalks ran the length of the wall up high, and leading toward them were a series of ladders and shorter catwalks as landings to hold supplies. He grabbed the bottom ladder and climbed up one level, then another. By the third one, his arms were aching. He made himself lighter, which helped, but he still had to stop and catch his breath on the fifth tier. Just as making his body heavier granted him the strength to move his oversized muscles, getting lighter always seemed to cost him some of his strength.
"Getting old," Wayne said with a grin, passing him and starting up the next ladder.
"Don't be dense," Wax said, grabbing the ladder below him and climbing. "I'm trying to pace myself. What if we reach the top and have to fight?"
"You can throw your wooden teeth at him," Wayne said from above. "Do some cane wagging as well. I'm sure you're cross about staying up so late."
Wax growled softly and climbed up onto the next tier, but in fact he was winded to the point that arguing was taxing. The younger man seemed to realize it and had a wide grin on his face as they climbed up the final two tiers to the bottom catwalk.
"I should deck you right in your grin," he grumbled as he joined the still-smiling Wayne on the catwalk. "But you'd just heel."
"Nah," Wayne said. "I'd fall over and groan. Considering your age, it's more important to make you feel you've accomplished something in a day."
Wax shook his head, turning and stepping to the side along the catwalk. The board under his foot immediately cracked. His leg slipped through, and though he caught himself and yanked the foot out, for the first time in ages he felt a little of what others must feel at being up so high. That ground was far, far below, and he didn't have any metals in him at the moment. He growled and stepped around the hole.
"That was not my fault. The board was weak."
"Sure, sure," Wayne said. "It's okay, mate. Most folks put on a little weight as they hit their twilight years. Snatural and all."
"If I shot you," Wax said, "nobody would blame me. They'd probably just say, 'Wow, you lasted that long? I'd have shot him years ago.' Then they'd buy me a pint."
"Now that hurts, it does," Wayne said. "I—"
"Who are you?"
Wax froze. Then both he and Wayne looked upward toward the person leaning out over the railing of the upper catwalk, staring down at them. An engineer, by the looks of it, in a white coat over vest and cravat. He frowned at them, then seemed to recognize Wax, his eyes widening.
"Rust," Wax swore, raising his hands as Wayne moved immediately, jumping up.
Wax gave him a boost, and he kicked off and grabbed the railing of the upper catwalk. The engineer started to cry out, but Wayne snatched the man's ankle, toppling him with a thump. Wayne swung up in a heartbeat, and another thump sounded. Wax waited, nervous. Moments passed.
"Wayne," he hissed, "are you up there?"
A moment later, the engineer's unconscious face appeared over the side of the catwalk, eyes closed.
"Of course he's up here," Wayne said from above, imitating the voice of the unfortunate engineer and wiggling the head like a puppet's. "You just tossed that bloke up here, mate. You've forgotten already. Memory loss. You must be getting real old."
Technically, every person in the world was dying. They were merely doing it very slowly. Eirik's curse was not that he was dying. It was that he could feel it happening. As he shuffled down the hallways of the enormous wooden ship, he had to keep close watch on the floor, because the slightest dip or cleft could cause him to trip. When he gestured toward the wall where they'd found the burned maps, explaining to the other scientists, his arm felt as if it were strapped with a 10-pound weight. His left hand barely worked anymore. He could grip his cane, but he couldn't stop his hand from trembling as he did so, and he practically had to drag his left leg with each step. The shortness of breath had begun. His physician said that one day he simply wouldn't have the strength to breathe. On that day, Eirik would suffocate alone, unable to move. And he could feel it coming, step by excruciating step.
"And what is this, Professor Eirik?"
Stanu asked, gesturing toward the ceiling.
"Such a fascinating pattern."
"We aren't certain," Eirik said,
leaning on his cane and looking upward, a task that was surprisingly difficult. Rusts, he hadn't had trouble tipping his head back before, had he? Step by step.
"It looks like a ship,"
Stanzi said, cocking her head. Indeed, the golden pattern on the corridor ceiling did look something like a small ship. Why paint it here? He suspected it would take years to sort out this vessel's many secrets. Once, Eirik would have been content to spend his entire life picking through these oddities, writing about each and every one. Today, however, his entire life seemed far too short a period to be spent on such endeavors. Suit and sequence wanted their weapons, and they could have them, for Eirik desired only one thing. A miracle.
"Please continue with me,"
Eirik said, walking down the corridor with his latest gait. He had to develop a new one every few months as more of his muscles grew too weak or refused to function. Step, cane, shuffle, breathe. Step, cane, shuffle, breathe.
"What marvelous woodwork," Stanu said, adjusting his spectacles. "Aunt, do you recognize what kind of wood this is?"
Stancy stepped up beside him, waving over the guard with the lantern so she could admire the strange hardwood. Eirik had shown similar interest in the ship's details at first, but each day his patience grew more strained.
"Please," Eirik said, "you shall have all the time you wish to study, prod, and theorize, but only after we have solved the primary problem."
"Which is?" Stancy asked.
Eirik gestured toward an arched doorway ahead, guarded by a soldier with another lantern. She saluted as Eirik passed. Technically, he was an array, a rank of some influence within the set. Suit and his people had a high regard for scientific thought. The power and prestige, however, were meaningless to him. Neither could grant him additional breaths of life. Past the doorway, he waved for his group of five scientists to gaze upon the grand machinery that filled the hold of the strange vessel. It was like nothing he had ever seen, without gears or wires. It looked more like a hearth, only constructed of a lightweight metal with lines of other metals running away from it along the walls, like a spider web.
"This ship," Eirik said, "is filled with enigmas. You have noticed the odd patterns on the ceilings, but questions like those are barely the beginning. What is the purpose of the room hung with dozens of black hoods, like those worn by an executioner? We have found what appear to be musical instruments, but they seem incapable of making any sounds. The ship has an ingenious system of plumbing, and we have identified facilities for both men and women. But there is a third set of rooms with an indecipherable marking on the doors. For whom were these built? People of the lower class? Families? A third gender? So many questions. One question tops them all. We feel that answering it will provide the very linchpin. It is why I have called for you, the most brilliant minds of the outer cities. If you can answer this, we will gain the technological might to secure our freedom from Elendil oppression once and for all.
And what question might that be? Professor Javy asked.
Eirik turned back to them.
Why, how this thing moves, of course.
You don't know?
Eirik shook his head.
It defies all scientific knowledge available to us. Some mechanisms were undoubtedly damaged in the crash, but as you can see, the vehicle is mostly intact. We should have been able to ascertain its method of propulsion, but so far it eludes us.
What of the navigators? Stenu asked. The crew? Did none survive?
They have been uncooperative,
Eirik said, and somewhat fragile.
Beyond that, the language barrier has so far proven insurmountable. That is why I invited you, Lord Stanu, as one of the world's foremost experts on ancient anti-verdant languages. Perhaps you can decipher the books found on this ship. Lady Stancy, you and Professor Javy will lead our engineers. Imagine the power we would have with a fleet of such ships. We would dominate the basin.
The scientists shared looks.
I don't know that I want any group having access to such power, Professor, Lady Stancy said.
Ah, right. These were not politicians. He should not employ the same rhetoric he had used when Suit sent him to gather funds from the wealthy.
Yes, he admitted. It will be a terrible burden. But surely you can see that this knowledge is better off in our hands, rather than in the hands of those at Elendil. And think of what we will learn, what we could know.
They took to that better, nodding in turn. He would have to speak with Suit. These people must not see themselves as serving a totalitarian army, but a benign freedom movement seeking knowledge and peace. That would be difficult, with all these rusted soldiers marching about and saluting everyone. He prepared for an explanation of what they knew, intending to divert the scientists with promises of knowledge, when he heard a voice echo down the hallway.
Professor Eirik?
He sighed. What now?
Excuse me, he said. Lady Stancy, perhaps you will wish to inspect this fixture, which appears to provide some kind of power to the ship. It does not have electricity, so far as we can discern. I would value your unbiased opinions before I tell you what we have concluded. I must go deal with something.
They seemed amenable to this, enthusiastic even. He left them and limped down the hallway. Too slow, he thought, both of his walk and the possibility of progress from the scientists. He couldn't wait upon research, experimentation. He needed answers now. He had thought that on the train they might find... But no, of course not. An idle hope. He should never have left this project. Back in the hallway, he found no sign of the person who had called to him. Frustrated, he made it all the way back to the doorway before turning and searching down one of the side hallways. They should know better than to call for him. Could they not see the difficulty he had in traversing even a short distance? He started back up the hallway, but hesitated as he noticed a small storage compartment that had popped open on the wall. There were hundreds of these scattered throughout the ship, containing ropes or weapons or other items. But this one had dropped something to the floor. A small, silvery cube. His heart leaped in excitement. Another of the devices? Such luck! He had thought all these compartments searched by now. He struggled to pick it up, going down on his good knee and fishing for it, then lurched back to his feet. A plan was already forming. He would tell Suit that it had been recovered by one of his spies in Nuseren. His punishments would be lifted, and perhaps he would be allowed to move to the second site, perhaps join the expedition. Excited, he sent a soldier to watch the scientists, then hobbled out of the ship, glad that something was finally going right for him. Marcy cracked a closet door within the strange ship, then looked after the man called Eirich, who limped through the gaping hole in the wall. Milan slipped out of a closet across the hallway from her and held up a warning hand to Marcy, then snuck to the opening to watch where Eirich went. Marcy waited, anxious. Though her duties as a constable usually related more to analysis and investigation, she'd gone on her share of raids in Ellendale. She'd thought herself hardened. But Harmony! This mission was starting to rub her nerves raw. Too little sleep and so much sneaking about, hiding, knowing that at any moment someone could turn a corner and find you there, looking guilty as sin. Milan finally waved her forward, and she scrambled out of the closet and knelt beside the Condra at the entrance.
"He went into that room,"
Milan said, pointing at a door along the wall.
"Now what?"
"We wait just a bit longer," Marcy said, "and see if he comes back out."
Wax prowled along the wooden planks of the interior scaffolding. Milan's spyglass let him get a good look at the ground floor, though he'd have much preferred binoculars. He scanned the whole area, noticing with interest as Marcy and Milan entered the ship. That ship. Something about it bothered him. He hadn't been on many boats, but the decks atop the enormous thing seemed off to him. Where were the masts? He'd assumed them torn down, but from above he could see no broken stumps. So, was this ship propelled through the water by a steam engine, perhaps? Gasoline? After rounding the entire building on the catwalk, he saw no sign of his uncle.
"Still nothing?"
Wayne asked as he lowered the spyglass a last time. Wax shook his head. "There are some rooms built into the north side of the structure. He could be in there. He might also be inside the ship."
"So what do we try next?"
Wax tapped the end of the spyglass against his palm. He'd been struggling with the same question. How did he find his prey without alerting the guards camped outside? Wayne nudged him. Down below, the limping man came back out of the boat. Wax focused the spyglass on him, watching as he crossed to one of the nearby rooms.
"Did he look anxious about something to you?" Wayne asked.
"Yeah," Wax said, lowering the spyglass. "What did those two women do in there?"
"Maybe they—"
"I don't want to hear your guess," Wax said. "Really."
"Fair enough."
"Come on," Wax said, leading the way back around the shadowed catwalks toward the ladders.
"You have an idea?"
Wayne asked.
"More of an impression," Wax said.
"Suit doesn't like talking to minions. Everyone we've interviewed indicates the same thing. He chooses underlings with some power and repute and lets them handle things. Miles, the marksman. My uncle loathes being bothered."
"So..."
"That man with the limp," Wax said, "probably has a similar role here. He's an allomancer, and I heard him referenced in Lady Kelesina's mansion. He's an important underling, though perhaps not in favor right now. Either way, he likely reports directly to my uncle."
"So we follow him long enough," Wayne said,
"and we should find Suit."
"Sounds good,"
Wayne said. Unless he reports every afternoon at tea, which would have us waiting a long time.
Wax paused by the ladder, noticing with surprise that the man with the limp had already left the rooms. Wax's view was partially obscured by the massive ship, but he did catch sight of the man hobbling around the front of the vessel, again walking with a determined air. Wax held up a hand to Wayne, then crouched down with the spyglass. The limping man crossed the warehouse to a solitary room, much like a guard chamber, built into the southwest corner. A soldier here stepped aside, letting the limping man enter. As the door swung open, Wax got a good glimpse of the room beyond. His sister was inside. He almost dropped the spyglass. The door swung shut so he couldn't get a second glimpse, but he had seen her. Sitting at a small table, loomed over by the large coin-shot brute Wax had fought on the train.
Wax? Wayne asked.
It's Tilson, Wax whispered. She's being held inside that room.
He found himself rising and reaching for one of his metal vials.
Whoa, whoa, mate, Wayne said, grabbing his arm. I'm all for charging in recklessly and whatnot, but don't you think it would be best to talk this through? You know, before we get all, let's shoot this place up.
She's here, Wayne, he said. This is why I came.
He felt cold.
She'll know things about her uncle. She's the key. I'm going in after her.
All right, Wayne said. But Wax, doesn't it strike you as worryish that I'm having to be the voice of reason here?
Wax looked down at his friend.
It probably should.
Yeah, I'll say. Look, I've got an idea.
How bad an idea is it?
Compared to burning Alamancy, going in shooting and inevitably drawing the attention of all those guards, not to mention the Set's kill squads, I'd say compared to that, it's a pretty damn good idea.
Tell me.
Well, say,
Wayne said, sticking his gum to one of the catwalk's support beams,
we've got this very nice engineer's outfit over there on the unconscious fellow, and ever since that party half a year back, I've been working on my smart person talk.